I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Ruby Namdar, author of the extraordinary new novel, The Ruined House. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Shinshinim, Chen Dinachi, and Tamir Shakuri. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. It's the final day of this very strange year, 2017, and it is our custom on Two Jewish to review the top Jewish stories of the previous secular year. This is the time we get all kinds of top 10 lists over the past 12 months, so why not a top 10 of important Jewish events? A recent guest of Two Jewish, Rabbi Jim Rudin, publishes his own list annually, and he has been doing so for 26 years, ever since 1991, nearly 11 years longer than Two Jewish has been on the air. His list of top Jewish stories for 2017 included the significant deaths of Jews like comedian Jerry Lewis, Otto Warmbier, the college student murdered by North Korea, and Yisrael Kristal, at 113 years old, the world's oldest man, all of them covered by Two Jewish, by the way. The rise of Jewish celebrity superstar Gal Gadot, Wonder Woman. The 100th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. The 70th anniversary of the UN vote for the partition of Palestine. And, of course, the 50th anniversary of the Six-Day War and the reunification of Jerusalem. The JCC bomb threats that frightened Jewish communities around North America and the world. And the continuing controversy over pluralistic Jewish prayer at the Western Wall, the Kotel, holiest place in the world for Jews, and under ultra-Orthodox monopoly control still after Bibi Netanyahu's government this year welched on the deal Natan Sharansky arranged a couple of years ago. Rabbi Rudin and many other top 10 Jewish lists also focused on President Donald Trump's strange mixed record on Jewish issues. That ranged from his daughter, son-in-law, and grandchildren's Orthodox Judaism, to Trump's failure to note the Jewish victims on Holocaust Remembrance Day last year, to his whirlwind trip to Israel and visit to the Kotel, the first sitting president to do so, to Trump's coddling of extremist anti-Semites, to his recognition of Jerusalem. It has been a very peculiar year indeed for the president on Jewish subjects. I mostly agree with Rabbi Rudin's top 10 Jewish stories list, particularly, however, his top two, which are very much worth highlighting this morning on the final 2017 edition of Two Jewish. The biggest Jewish stories last year, according to Two Jewish, were the shocking rise of very public anti-Semitic rallies and rhetoric symbolized by the neo-Nazi Klan and Aryan Nation rally and riot in Charlottesville, Virginia last summer, and the top issue, the December announcement of the U.S. recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. That Charlottesville rally, in case you've forgotten, was organized by extremist right-wing groups to protest the removal of a statue of Robert E. Lee. That's a movement in the South to take down Confederate monuments that was prompted by the Charleston Church Massacre in 2015. This rally, called Unite the Right, had fringe elements made up of white supremacists, white nationalists, neo-Confederates, Klansmen, neo-Nazis, and various militia groups. The marchers chanted racist and anti-Semitic slogans, including "Jews will not replace us," carried semi-automatic rifles and pistols, swastikas, Confederate battle flags, Trump-Pence signs, anti-Muslim and anti-Semitic banners, including "Jews are Satan's children," and other Nazi signs. The marchers tried to intimidate Jews attending synagogue in Charlottesville that Shabbat, and eventually clashed with counter-protesters. Both sides had permits to assemble, by the way. Finally, a terrorist car ramming by a white supremacist killed a woman and injured 19 others. Seeing this sort of conduct in 2017 America, with a very public chanting of anti-Semitic slogans immediately available to view on Facebook, YouTube, and everywhere else on the web, was shocking to Jews who thought this kind of thing was only happening in Europe or the Arab world. Adding to the distress, President Trump had a very difficult time condemning the rally and its organizers, although other American leaders across the political and religious spectrum did so immediately. As late as 4 days after the riot and attack in Charlottesville, the president publicly said there were very good people on both sides, reversing his own published statement issued 2 days before. While the president's Charlottesville public relations debacle may have helped lead to White House senior advisor and alt-right figure Steve Bannon's exit from the White House just 2 weeks later, the events demonstrate we may have to expect further anti-Semitic and extremist propaganda from both the left and the right in America in 2018.
We've been traveling from state to state, and I don't understand what they say. 3,000 years with no place to be, and them want me to give up my milk and honey. Don't you see? It's not about the land or the sea, not the country, but the dwelling of His Majesty. Jerusalem, if I forget you, fire not gonna come from it. Jerusalem, if I forget you, let my right hand forget what it's supposed to do. Jerusalem.
But the biggest Jewish story of 2017, and we'll explore its implications and complexities with our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, over the next few weeks, is the American recognition of Jerusalem as capital of Israel by the Trump administration in early December. On the surface, this has long seemed like an obvious act the U.S. should have taken long ago. Jerusalem's been the capital of Israel since at least 1950. The Israeli government buildings and ministries are all in the new city of Jerusalem, or Western Jerusalem, which has always been located on land that unquestionably and by all international standards belongs to the State of Israel. A series of American presidents have promised to recognize Israel and move the U.S. embassy from its coastal location in Tel Aviv to the true capital. But because of Arab pressure and that of the larger Muslim world, and now the resistance of European and Asian countries, each president since 1992, at least, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama among them, has changed his mind and chosen not to recognize Jerusalem as the capital and not move the embassy. Donald Trump changed this when he publicly announced the recognition of the fact that Jerusalem is the capital. It remains to be seen if or when the embassy will actually move to Jerusalem, where a huge U.S. consulate is well situated to become the new embassy. The U.N. General Assembly overwhelmingly condemned the U.S. declaration, which is no surprise. The U.N. is spectacularly obsessed with condemning Israel and biting the U.S. hand that feeds it, to the near total exclusion of fulfilling its theoretical role to advance peace, justice, education, and human rights in the world. That isn't really of note, to be honest. What is notable is that the issue, largely a symbolic one, has highlighted a divide in the Jewish world. While the vast majority of Israelis, including most of the Israeli left, supports the American declaration of Jerusalem as capital, and the conservative and Orthodox movements and almost all Zionist organizations in America also support it, the Reform Movement and J Street opposed it publicly. Not all Reform Jewish figures, by the way, opposed the move. Rabbi Eric Yaffe, past president of the Union for Reform Judaism and a multiple past guest of Two Jewish, and Rabbi Ami Hirsch, the senior rabbi of Stephen Wise the Free Synagogue in New York and past head of Artsa, separately published popular pieces in the Jewish press delineating their reasons why the Reform Movement was wrong to condemn President Trump's action and why we should welcome and support it, whatever our personal feelings about Trump himself or his other policies. As noted, this is a symbolic issue. In my view, it will fade as more tangible concerns appear in 2018. But as 2017 comes to its end, some of us are quite glad of that, by the way, it is also clear that symbolic issues like pulling down old statues or diplomatic recognition or holy walls, or even cinematic Jewish woman superheroes, sometimes these symbolic things supersede pragmatic real things. What was it the old Andre Agassi ad for Canon cameras said? Image is everything? Well, it's not true. But sometimes, like in 2017, it seemed to come pretty close. Hoping for a new year of 2018 that has more real accomplishments and fewer symbolic clashes, and to play us in this morning, here's cantor David Dudu Fischer's Shana Tova, a schmaltzy song, but a nice one. May you have a new year of peace and tranquility.
Shana Tova, Shana Tova. Slicha dam ahava avi pius vegam shalva yamim holchim yamim baim silchi gam at lachataim rab icholim simchi noflim Chesed uverachamim, Shana Tova, Kirvi Halom, Ve'yad Hoshiti Leshalom. Shana Tova,
Shana Tova,
Shana Tova.
That was cantor David Dudu Fischer singing a slightly schmaltzy Shana Tova for the new secular year that starts tonight at midnight. Our guest this morning, Reuven Ruby Namdar, is the author of an extraordinary new book, The Ruined House. His Jewish background and depth of knowledge are also exceptional. Find out about him when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Ruby Namdar, who has written an extraordinary book called The Ruined House. It's his first novel. Lest you think that Ruby is a woman's name, it's from Reuven. He was born and raised in Jerusalem. He's a Yerushalmi to a family of Iranian Jewish heritage. His first book, Chaviv, won the Israeli Ministry of Culture's Award for Best First Publication. And The Ruined House won the 2014 Sapir Prize, Israel's most important literary award. It is now available in English, translated by perhaps the best Hebrew to English translator since the days of the Meturgamans, Hillel Halkin. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Good morning. Nice to be here.
So, I think of magic realism when I read your book, but it's an extraordinary book. Tell me a little bit about how the book evolved.
Okay, the book was, first of all, it took a long time to write. This is the result of 10 years of hard work. I started writing it very shortly after I came to New York in the year 2000 as a kind of a response to the great experience of America, New York, and American Jewry, which was a discovery for me as an Israeli.
Of course.
And the magical realism element there just were born with the work. It seemed like, you know, New York in itself is a place that sometimes you feel you're walking into a magic realism, work of magical realism.
And then somebody yells at you 2 seconds later.
Exactly, and you snap out of the magic, yes.
Right, right. And I think that book carries some of that. This is the first book that I can recall in which actual pages that look like Dapim, the Talmud pages, show up. Your background is obviously very rich in Jewish knowledge. Tell us a little bit about it.
Okay, I was not raised in the yeshiva world, which is... It's sad and happy at the same time, because I was, on one hand, I had to discover the vast treasures of classic Jewish texts on my own later in life, and it's an obsession of mine. I'm very, very interested in classic Jewish texts, ancient Jewish texts. I teach it, I study it. I cannot have enough of it. But the good thing about not being raised with it was that I was also able to look at it from the outside as a you know, modern Western writer, rather than being too steeped in it to see the beauty of it. So for me, there's a great artistic value in Talmud, not just ethical and an identity value, but it's really a very artistically stimulating experience.
It's fascinating to think of Talmud as aesthetics, but it is. We will.
It is, totally, if you think about it.
We will continue this discussion with author Ruby Namdar. His extraordinary book is called The Ruined House, and we come back in just a moment here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's twojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can stream all past and present shows through the website or download us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, we started talking about Chabad not too long ago. By the way, that's an acronym, Chochma Bina Dea. It has to do with the principles of Lubavitch Hasidim, which revolve around, I don't know, the best way to describe it would be sort of this passionate dedication to Hasidus, piety, and the notion that simple mitzvot are so critical, and also this kind of outreach aspect of Chabad, which was framed and structured by the sainted Lubavitcher Rebbe, who some Chabadniks believe was the Messiah or will be the Messiah again. Leaving all of that aside, we were talking about the influence of Chabad in Eastern Europe, but that is certainly not restricted to there. Let's talk a little more broadly.
Right, and since you referred to Chabad as being an acronym, let's go through the three words. Chachma is wisdom, Bina is understanding, Dea is like belief. And it's not a place, it's not a dynasty, really. It's an acronym for those three pillars of the Chabad worldview. What's interesting is I just came back from Hong Kong, and in the middle of one of the few public squares downtown near the General Post Office, near the Supreme Court, and near another building ironically called the Court of Last Appeal, there's a huge menorah put up by Chabad at Hanukkah time, but even after. And unlike other places in the world, there's a poster that explains what Hanukkah is and why there's a menorah and what it represents. And they do a pretty good job of public education. And I began to think about where is Chabad active and why. And a couple answers come to mind. First of all, young Israelis, when they finish their military service, if they have any money at all, will save and scrape together a pocketful of money and go on a big trip. And it might be India, it might be Thailand, it might be the Far East. It's frequently South America, right, where they do a whole hiking trail up and down the West Coast. And everywhere that young Israelis go in droves, wherever it is in the world, Chabad is active,
right,
trying to recruit people or make them feel at home, offer them kosher meals, offer them a
Seder at Pesach. I had Seder in Cuzco, Peru. The biggest one in the world is in Kathmandu.
A Passover Seder or a Hanukkah latke party or whatever might draw them in, you know, free food, socializing, some booze, whatever.
Other Jews.
And this may not make converts to Chabad's worldview, but it does bring people into Jewish life in a way that feels warm and welcoming. And the other place that they focus on, and the two are not mutually exclusive, except in the case of South America, is places full of young MBAs from the US or Canada or the UK who are working at international banks in international financial centers like Singapore and Hong Kong, which both have small indigenous Jewish communities, mostly expatriates, not exclusively, the descendants of Iraqi merchant families,
right, Baghdadi families
from the days of the British Empire are still there. But largely, the Jewish communities in these places are expatriates from North America or Western Europe who are often Jewish, not always, obviously, but they are also attracted for the same reason as young Israelis, to be with people kind of their own age, of vaguely similar backgrounds, and to do things that feel at home, like eating latkes at Hanukkah time. So the pattern of activity of Chabad and the presence of Chabad around the world is actually determined by multiple factors. Some people find it just annoying. I find it mostly harmless and sometimes heartwarming to see the fellowship that springs up among strangers just because they're joining together doing some traditional Jewish activity.
Yeah, you know, and I've talked about being at Chabad in Marrakesh, Morocco, and having Shabbat at Chabad in Venice, Italy, and, you know, it's kind of everywhere. Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome the Shin Shinim, Chen Denachi and Tamir Shakuri, representing the Weintraub Israel Center, representing Israel here. Good morning, welcome, and we say in America, Happy New Year.
Good morning. Good morning.
So it's not exactly Shana Tova, but we know how Americans celebrate New Year's. They drink too much champagne, stay up till midnight, and then lie around the next day and watch parades and football games. I don't know why it's a holiday, except it's the end of one thing, beginning of another. How do Israelis celebrate New Year's, and do they celebrate this New Year? Because we already had one, you know, in September for Rosh Hashanah, and there's some changes.
So basically New Year's is kind of the same, a lot of parties, a lot of champagne. But in Israel, there's this phenomenon that started lately that I've encountered, that I have some friends that their parents come from Russia, and maybe some of them were also born in Russia, I think. And they celebrate New Year's as Novi God, which is like, it's the Russian version of it. So it's the celebration of the new Gregorian calendar year. And I felt like as a Jew, I don't have a lot of a connection to New Year's the normal way, and also to Novigrad. So I feel like I do celebrate it to be with my friends and hang out and have fun. But it's not like Rosh Hashanah, which is really a celebration of a new year and a fresh start for me. It's more just like a fun and crazy day.
So Novi Gud, which I just learned about from you guys, apparently it's kind of a big Russian celebration. There's a lot of Russians in Israel, no?
Yeah, there are. And some of them just really insist to make the Sylvester into Novi Gud. I'm not sure what kind of traditions come with it, but I just go with it because I feel like if they want to feel like they have this day for themselves to celebrate something that is theirs, then I appreciate it because not a lot of people in Israel are really exposed to everything the Russian culture has to offer, so I'm all for it.
Chen, your experience of New Year's in Israel?
So, I mean, New Year's in Israel, for most of the time, I hate to say I was asleep. It's always a school night. And I don't know, I mean, people do celebrate it, and I think it's good. I mean, regardless of the origin, I think that celebration of a new year is something good. We don't really need a siba le mesiba, a cause for celebration. And I don't know, it's good to have like the resolutions. I like it, even though you usually don't go through with it. It's nice to know what you want from yourself for this new year. And I like the idea of it. I wish I could stay awake.
Maybe this year will be the first. You know, I should add,
on my flight.
I was in Israel for Valentine's Day a couple years ago, which never used to be anything in Israel. And all these people were out on dates and they decorated with hearts.
Yeah, thought, Valentine's Day is big.
Israel doesn't mind adding new holidays, even if they aren't Jewish in origin, and making it their own.
No, we are not intimidated.
Thanks so much. A good 2018. May it be another year of growth and blessing.
Thank you. You too.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Moshe goes to see his rabbi and says, "Rabbi, last week I missed saying Birkat HaMazon, the grace after meals." "That's not so bad," the rabbi answers. "Why did you forget?" "Well," Moshe says, "I forgot to wash my hands before the meal." "All right, you broke Jewish law twice, but neither is a major offense," says the rabbi. "But you still haven't told me why you did that." "Well," answers Moshe, the food wasn't actually kosher." "You ate non-kosher food?" asks the rabbi. "Yes, Rabbi, but that's only because it wasn't a Jewish restaurant." "That makes it worse," says the angry rabbi. "Couldn't you have eaten in a kosher restaurant?" "What?" says Moshe. "On Yom Kippur?" You see, Yom Kippur is a fast day, and anyway, that was the old Jewish joke of the week. Not exactly timely for this part of the year, but still pretty good. A special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we begin reading Exodus, the second book of Torah, with the great portion of Shmot. I admit I'm a little biased. This was my own bar mitzvah Torah portion, but Shmot is certainly one of the greatest sections of Torah of all. It begins with a kind of coda on Genesis, recounting how the first family of Bereshit, made up of Jacob and his many sons and their descendants, all moved down to Egypt, where Joseph is the effective ruler of the country. They settled in Goshen in the north of Egypt and flourished there. And then the fateful events that set the future of our people begin. Joseph and his generation pass away. A new dynasty takes over in Egypt, which doesn't remember Joseph and his contributions. And the Israelites are now viewed differently. As they grow in numbers and wealth, the new pharaoh worries. The immigrants might serve as a fifth column in the event of invasion. They speak a different language, worship a different god. Their hair is curlier, their noses larger, their skin a bit darker. They certainly have funny accents. They look like trouble. Isn't it interesting how history is a way of repeating itself? How the same negative stereotypes and wicked ways of looking at Jews and, well, all immigrants recur. And so the Egyptians enslave the Israelites, putting them to work as unpaid slave labor building store cities, not pyramids, by the way, for the royal government. They set up overseers called taskmasters, establish work quotas, push them harder and harder, try basically to work them to death. When that fails, the Hebrews are
tougher than the Egyptians thought, they decide to simply kill all the male babies, eliminating the whole masculine population in one generation. But the Jews are too crafty for their oppressors. In the tribe of Levi, later to be the priestly tribe, a woman hides her newborn boy baby until his cries are too loud to be stifled. She puts him in a tiny ark, a new Noah, if you will, and sets him a sail in the Nile River. And when the Pharaoh's daughter pulls him from the river and names him Moses, a remarkable personal story is begun. Shmot tells of the early life and adolescence of Moses, his instinctive outrage at injustice, his hot temper, his exile to the Sinai. It shows him maturing, marrying, fathering children in the desert. And then it takes him through the dramatic narrative of the burning bush, an encounter with a commanding God who will bring him back into the crucible of history, lead him to become the greatest liberator the world had ever known. Finally, it returns Moses to Egypt to meet his brother Aaron and shape his destiny, and ultimately ours. There is almost too much in this one Torah portion to grasp fully, encapsulating as it does so many of the formative tales of our people's religious history. But most importantly, unlike so many other traditions' hero stories, Exodus does not make Moses into a god, or even into a perfect paragon. He is just a man. A great, flawed man, born into a conflict not of his own making, rising to that greatness only through trial and error, learning both how to follow God and how to lead people towards justice and freedom. Shmot is a great story, of course, but more than that, it is a powerful lesson. Moses became the model for every truly great leader thereafter because of his very humanness, his ability to empathize with the suffering of the downtrodden, to utilize the power of righteousness to accomplish everything. May we come to understand as well that we can accomplish great things too if we choose, in spite of our own imperfections and limitations, that we can fight for justice, freedom, and truth. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Ruby Namdar, will explain the influences and development of his remarkable new novel, Ruined House. Hear all about it when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Jarrow Psychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Jarrow Psych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Jarrow Psychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In Buenos Aires, Argentina, the unsolved terrorist attack 23 years ago that destroyed the Asociación Mutual Israelita Argentina building, shattered the Argentinian Jewish community, and involved the highest levels of the Argentinian government in a cover-up of Iranian guilt, edged closer to finally revealing the truth. Last week, a federal judge in Argentina said that the prosecutor of the notorious Amia Jewish Center bombing case, Alberto Nisman, was murdered. This is the first time since Nisman's death in January 2015 that the case has officially been classified as murder. Until now, the official explanation was that Nisman committed suicide in the bathroom of his Buenos Aires apartment. In a 656-page ruling, Judge Julian Ercolini said the gunshot that killed Jewish prosecutor Nisman was not a suicide and was brought about by a third party. The decision charged Diego Lagomarsino, a former employee of Nisman's, as an accessory to the murder.
Following Nisman's death, Lagomarsino said he went to the prosecutor's apartment to give him a very old .22 caliber pistol to protect himself after Nisman expressed fears he was being targeted by supporters of then-President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner. Hours later, Nisman was found dead from a bullet gun fired at point-blank range above his right ear. Prior to last week, Lagomarsino had been charged only with lending the pistol to Nisman. The judge noted that Lagomarsino was the last known person to enter Nisman's apartment. His body was found January 18, 2015, just hours before he was to present evidence to Argentine lawmakers that Kirchner covered up Iran's role in the attack on the Amiya Jewish Center in Buenos Aires that left 85 dead and hundreds more wounded in July of 1994. Lagomarsino, an IT technician, will remain under surveillance with an electronic ankle bracelet. The judge froze his bank accounts. The judge also charged four police guards responsible for Nisman's safety with aggravated concealment and failure to comply with the duties of a public official. The Argentinian investigation continues. When it concludes, Ercolini will present the case to a panel of three judges who will conduct a courtroom trial and arrive at a sentence for those charged. In other stories, thousands of asylum seekers from Eritrea and Sudan will soon be told to leave Israel within 3 months or face prison terms. The Israeli Misrad HaPnim, the Interior Ministry's Population, Immigration, and Border Authority, has begun preparing to deport asylum seekers on the orders of Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu, Interior Minister Aryeh Deri, and Public Security Minister Gilad Erdan. In the first stage, certain groups will be exempted from deportation: children, adults over 60, parents of minor children who rely on them for support, those with serious medical or mental health problems, and victims of human trafficking and slavery. Individuals in those groups are exempt from being sent to the Holot detention facility in the Negev. People who have applied for refugee status but have not yet received a response will also be allowed to stay for now. Thousands of other African migrants who entered Israel illegally and who have been detained at Holot in the past, or who meet the criteria for detention there, will receive notification they must leave Israel within 3 months. That will be given when they go to Interior Ministry offices to renew residency permits or face indefinite imprisonment. Barring changes to the new law, Holot is scheduled for closure in 3 months. There are an estimated 27,000 citizens of Eritrea living in Israel, 7,500 Sudanese nationals, and 2,500 people from other African nations. Some 5,000 children have been born to African asylum seekers in Israel. Mind you, these are not Jewish asylum seekers. If they were Jewish, they would be incorporated as citizens. Netanyahu has told Interior Ministry officials that he expects many of these people to leave Israel within a short period. For now, every asylum seeker who leaves Israel will receive $3,500 from the Israeli government. This amount may be reduced in the future. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Ruby Namdar's extraordinary first novel, a work, as he told us earlier, of 10 years, is called The Ruined House. It's a remarkable exploration of sort of the magic of New York and deeply Jewish and infused with Jewish texts, but also extraordinarily contemporary. The protagonist in your book, Andrew Cohen, is very stylish, good-looking guy. Of course, that's modeled on you, right?
Of course. I wish. 30, 40 pounds later, you know?
Yeah, you know, a little time in the gym, it might do it. You know, the way in which you guide us through this extraordinary journey, you know, you said it took a long time. It almost feels Talmudic in the approach. Was that intentional?
It is very interesting that you noticed it. It is intentional, of course, and it is wonderful that you see it. The Talmud is not just a book or a textual mode. The Talmud is a state of mind. There is something about it that there's a main text and then a whole halo of commentary that travels with the text at all time, and that has a few times in it at the same time, in parallel. And this is, of course, yes, the story of Andrew Cohen is the main text, and then there's the whole midrash around it. Yes, that is part of the project. I'm very happy that it worked and you could see it.
No, I think absolutely it works. There's a, you know, the Temple Mount is one of the most controversial spaces in the world and has been for a very long time. You know, as modern Jews, Reform Jews, Conservative Jews, contemporary Israelis, people don't think very much about the actual rituals of the Temple in Jerusalem, and yet that becomes a focus of the book. How did you decide to do that, and how did it lead you in?
Okay, look, I grew up in Jerusalem, and
well, you don't have to say any more then.
Exactly. The Kotel was there, the Temple Mount was there, the mosques were there. The tension between the past and the present was always there. But even then, when growing up in Jerusalem, the temple was a distant and absent symbol. It wasn't such a live symbol as it has become today in Israel, where suddenly in Israel, the movement to renew the temple and the avodah, the work of the sacrifices and the priestly practices, suddenly now there's a strong, small, but very strong and vocal movement that is pushing to take this metaphor and make it concrete again. For me, it was, I could not think of a better way to symbolize the deep consciousness of our people. It is not something, it's like the reptilian mind of our culture, the deep memory. We have gone very far as contemporary Jews from the practices of the temple. But they are echoing in everything we do as Jews. Every prayer we say is a substitute for the real thing, which was a sacrifice in the temple. And therefore, I was interested to go to the depth of our collective memory and take the thing that was perhaps the most distant, the least intuitive element of our culture, and to bring it into the life of the least suspecting suspect. You know, the person who Andrew Cohen is the last person you would suspect of thinking consciously about the temple. So it's the great distance between our contemporary protagonist's mind and this ancient symbol. The tension between them is what I was trying to capture.
You know, it's fascinating the way that you do it, because, you know, when you're in Jerusalem, it always seems, not always, sometimes it's perfectly peaceful, and then, you know, the next day or 2 hours later or 10 seconds later, there's some explosion, and that tension becomes real. But outside of there, it seems so archaic, and yet here you bring it so freshly to life in New York, which styles itself as the most contemporary city on earth.
Yes, absolutely. One thing about New York, though, is that New York has a certain quality that I cannot but refer to as a sacred city. There's something about New York that like brings so much meaning, so much attention, kavana, yes, intention, that the city marks itself as a place that's larger than life. And for me, New York is sitting on the same continuum, such as Jerusalem, Rome, and other cities in the world where you feel the presence of time, the past, and the deep past. Even though New York is a pretty new city, it carries itself as an ancient city in many ways, a city of saturated with memory. As a Jerusalemite, I actually feel comfortable in New York. I recognize this type of energy.
You know, I have a friend who said he moved from Manhattan to Jerusalem, from the most tense place in the world to an even more tense place.
Yes, exactly. I think that the tension, yeah, that's a very good way of putting it. It's all about a certain kind of tension that for people who are tuned to it, is actually a very fertile mental environment. The intensity of Jerusalem, the intensity of New York feeds my imagination.
I'm reminded in your work sometimes, particularly when you're writing about New York, of Mark Halperin. I don't know if you know his work well, but
I don't know his work well, but I know it enough to know it's wonderful.
In the interest of a full disclosure, a past guest of Too Jewish and maybe my favorite author of all time, also Jewish. Mm. But,
yes.
But writing about New York with a certain extraordinary sense of vision and clarity and light, and yet love. You love New York, don't you?
I do love New York. I do love New York. There's something about New York that, with all its, you know, there is a cruelty and obtuseness to the city that many people know, but there's also a it's a very accepting city. It is easy and okay to be a foreigner here. It's easy and okay to be Jewish here, which is an important thing. As a Jew, you don't feel as an outsider in this city. And that's it's a big deal to be in a place where we're not constantly reminded of our outsiderness. Also, I like the sense of mythology. New York has a great mythology about it, and that again, as an artist, I'm inspired by it. Hence, the great ode that I at times sing to the city in the novel. It's to the mythological sense that the city produces.
You know, this book feels like it's going towards some, and I don't want to, any spoilers here. It feels like it should go to some traumatic, event. Sometimes magic realism jumps the rails at the end, in which it sort of flies off into, the golem comes to life or something. Again, I don't want to blow the book for anybody who's just ready to read it, but you don't do that. It doesn't jump the rails, as it were.
No, it was important for me not to jump the rails. It was important for me to keep it, to eventually keep what's happening in the realm of the protagonist's mind, and not to cross the line. It is something that, it's easier in many ways to break the rule of your own work and just mix the genres. I like to walk on this very thin line between realism and imagination, between mind and world. And I wanted not to disrupt it. I wanted to actually to keep a certain sort of ambiguity about what actually happened. That's why that event that you are wisely referring to, which we're not going to mention,
right,
is I call it the focal point of the work that's outside of the frame. It's there. It's clearly where everything is flowing towards, but we don't go to that actual place. Because between us, the real trauma that we are handling in this book is the trauma of the past, is the great destruction of the past and its impact on us today. More importantly than the modern destruction. That's how I felt about this work.
Because it's not an individual destruction, it's a collective
exactly.
People
it's
experience.
Collective, yes. Exactly, and it's formative. I cannot stress enough the importance of what happened to us about 2,000 years ago, when the Second Temple was destroyed and our people was dispersed, yes, sent everywhere and uprooted from the land of Israel. Very few Jews actually were allowed to remain. And the rest, we were just dispersed all over the world, very brutally. And this is the birth of Judaism as we know it today, okay? Which is the birth through trauma, terrible trauma. And so much of who we are as Jews today, including, by the way, the great and wonderful, if you will, overreaction that's called Zionism,
yeah,
is to compensate for this terrible loss and terrible the cracks that the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem have left in our collective soul. And we are not aware of how important it was. It was bigger than the Holocaust. What happened to us then? Bigger even than the Holocaust. In my opinion, very formative. Very, very formative to us. And also, I want to say one more thing, that for me, the destruction and the ruin of the house is not just the political or religious home. It's also the individual temples that we each have and cherish that eventually we lose or we actually are expelled from. So for me, it's not just a collective tragedy. Each one of us has ruined temples. Each one of us has shrines that were desecrated. And that's as important for me as the collective.
You know, it's almost as if the greatest possibility spiritually was destroyed in the year 70, and we can never access that again, short of the Messiah.
Yes, we are. If you think about it, we are now in constant therapy, constant analysis.
No wonder we invented psychoanalysis.
Exactly. Talking in shul while prayer about the loss of this immediacy of connection that the temple represented. Now, at the same time, you know, the funny thing about the temple is that we know of it through, you know, it's preserved in the amber of memory through our Talmudic text and Midrashic text. The same text, in the same page, in the same paragraph, can give you a wonderful story, romantic, amazing, about the holy, pure place that it was. And two lines later, it could tell you about corruption, greed, competition between rich families in Jerusalem about who's gonna show off their power more while the services at Yom Kippur are happening. So there's this complexity that is wonderful to me.
Right.
The stories of the temple. It's really complex, the relationship with the place. Which, of course, I love.
It's amazing. I have to ask you a separate question. You come from an Iranian Jewish background, which is an incredible Jewish community that I think most Jews don't know very much about.
In America, most of the Jews in America are Ashkenazi, which means they come from Central and mostly Eastern Europe.
Right.
And in Israel, there are many more communities that, you know, we have Iranian Jews in America, we have some Syrian Jews and Moroccan Jews, but it's much less so than in Israel. There are heritages that were different than the heritage that that most of American Jewry knows. They differ in food and language and exterior. But if you dig a little deeper, you find that the Jewishness was very similar in many ways. The relationship to our cultural roots was similar, and really it was one people, miraculously preserved over this
extraordinary length of time.
Extraordinary, 2,000 years of dispersion, yeah. And yet so much connection between the various Jewish tribes that are all over the world, and yet there's so much connection between them. And we all go back to the same source, and it's very much felt in our culture.
I want to thank Ruby Namdar for a marvelous visit here on Too Jewish. I wish we could go on much longer. We're out of time.
Next time in New York.
Next time in New York, as we say. Next year in New York.
Exactly. Thank you. This was wonderful.
Oh, no, it's fantastic. His book is called The Ruined House, and you should read it. It's amazing, and he has so much to teach us, really, about our connection to holiness and God and the temple and today. Thanks again. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be Nitzana Darshan Leitner, founder of Shurat Hadin Israel Law Center, which has recovered hundreds of millions of dollars from terror organizations to compensate terror victims. She's the co-author of the book Harpoon, Inside the Covert War Against Terrorism's Money Masters. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning comes from David Schlossberg, his instrumental CD, A Place Beyond Words. It's his version of Moshe Rothblum's Vishamru, beautiful piano CD. My friends, may you have a happy and safe secular new year of 2018, a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, and a new secular year, we pray, of peace.
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.